This episode of The Lou Rockwell Show is sponsored by...
Do you want liberty in your lifetime? The Free State Project is our best chance. We are people who know that liberty will not be achieved by more of the same tactics and are committed to a strategy that will work. Check us out on the web at freestateproject.org. That's freestateproject.org.
This is The Lou Rockwell Show.
Well, what a pleasure to have with us this morning Dr. Walter Block. Walter is professor of economics at Loyola University in New Orleans. He holds a chair there. Author of many books, many hundreds of articles.
Yes.
I mean, just extraordinarily prolific as an Austrian economist and as a libertarian. And Walter, recently you've been involved in a huge brouhaha involving the Thought Police, the people who came after you gave a talk for Tom DiLorenzo at Loyola College in Baltimore. What the heck happened?
Tom DiLorenzo was kind enough to invite me to his school, Loyola College of Maryland in Baltimore.
Yes.
And he asked me to do two things. One, talk about Defending the Undefendable, one of my books, in his class. And then talk about social justice.
Let me just interrupt you, Walter, and mention Defending the Undefendable, one of the great ways to learn economics. I mean, that the most fun, probably the most fun way to learn economics is to read that book. And let me mention, you can get it on Mises.org, or it's at the bottom of any of Walter's articles on LouRockwell.com. And by the way, take a look at his archive on LouRockwell.com. It's terrific. So, Walter, excuse me for interrupting
you. No. Thanks. Interruptions are certainly welcome. When I wrote that book, it was sort of an homage to Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. Again, we don't discuss quality, but in terms of format, each of the two books is similar in the sense that you have a lesson and then 35 examples of it. And I was delighted that when I was asked to write an introduction to the Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, which is sort of that plus Atlas Shrugged were the two books that converted me to libertarianism. Okay, so what happened is Tom then asked me to speak not only to his class on defending, but also to this seminar he was putting on social justice. And it was an interesting experience. What happened was there was this not very big room. I think the room would hold maybe 100 seats, but there was just floor-to-ceiling kids. They were sitting all over the floor. They were hanging on the banisters, and it was just maybe 150 people in a room for 100. It was a very favorable audience. They were very supportive. I asked a poll of them, and they cooperated. And what I started off by saying was, well, social justice can mean two things. One, it could mean what the lefties thinks it mean, namely egalitarianism or socialism or some version of that. Or we could try to seize it for ourselves and just say, well, social justice is justice applied to social issues, and then we can use our libertarian analysis on that. And then I took as my case in point the fact that females earn less than males. And why is that? And I also explored the glass ceiling. And why is it that women only rise so high? They become assistant principals or assistant presidents or assistant, colonels, not generals, whatever. They only rise so high. And I gave an analysis very similar to what Jim Giott gave the other day here at the Austrian Scholars Conference. Namely, there's a bell curve. And while men and women have equal ability on average, the men are spread out all over the place. Their standard deviation or their variance is much bigger. The way Jim Giott put it, they're dumbbells and Nobels, whereas the Nobel Prize winners, whereas women are more clustered toward the center. So if you go out to the right tail, where the presidents and the chiefs and the grandmasters in chess reside, men outnumber women to a gigantic degree, and that's why we have the bell curve. And I gave socio-biological reasons why this should be the case, why it's necessary based on our biology that it would be that way. And I also said that the male-female differences are mainly to do with marriage. Marriage is asymmetrical. Marriage enhances male incomes and reduces female incomes because of unequal distribution of work in the household. Women do the lion's share of house cleaning and cooking and childcare and things like that. And I gave the example, since I was in Baltimore, of that swimmer, what's his name, Phelps?
Michael Phelps.
Michael Phelps. And I said, I'll bet you Michael Phelps is not a world-class cellist. Why? Well, because he's in the pool all day, and if you want to be a world-class cellist, you got to play the cello a lot, you know, 6, 8, 10 hours a day. He's no Yo-Yo Ma. And if women are busy doing housework, they have to do it at the cost of something, because there are alternative costs. There are only 24 hours in a day. So they have to do something else less well than would otherwise be the case did they not do all this housework, and that's why they make less money. And I gave two proofs. The first proof or evidence or whatever you want a demonstration of this was the fact that if you take the all men and all women, there is a wage gap of some 30%. But if you take married women and married men, the wage gap is gigantic. It's more like 60%. Whereas if you take never marrieds, people who have never been touched by the institution of marriage, there is no wage gap. And the 70% ratio or the 30% gap is an amalgamation of a gigantic gap of marrieds and no gap of non-marrieds. And since there are more marrieds than non-marrieds, you get a 30% gap. And if you take the ratio of forgetting about marriage or not, but using a proxy variable for marriage age, namely if you take males and females aged 18 to 24, again, there's no gap.
Let's take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Is the growth of government driving you crazy? Is it frustrating you that you can't do anything about it? Now you can. Join the Free State Project. Move to New Hampshire and get active with other liberty activists who have already slowed the growth of government in New Hampshire. Go to freestateproject.org.
So it's got nothing to do with sexism or anything like that. The market is not sexist. It's just that this phenomenon of marriage.
So you were placed under arrest.
Well, not quite. And then I gave the second proof. I said, well, if it was really true that men and women had equal abilities and women were paid a lot less than men, wouldn't this open up a profit opportunity? Wouldn't everyone want to hire a woman? And if they did, they could undercut or undersell the people hiring men. Namely, this can't last. So those were the two proofs. And that pretty much ended my discussion. I mean, it took me an hour to say this, but and now I'm saying it in 5 minutes, but I'm just summarizing. Mm-hmm. And then during the question period, well, we had maybe 5 or 10 questions. And the very last question, just as we were sort of having to get out of the room because a new class was coming in or whatever it was, some kids said, well, what about the wage gap between blacks and whites? It's roughly 30% also, and it can't be the marital asymmetry hypothesis. What is it? And I said, well, just as in the case of women, it's lower productivity. For women, it's low productivity in the market because of higher productivity in the household. Well, why then is there lower productivity for blacks than whites in the market? And I said, well, there are two theories. The first theory is that it's a residue of slavery, Jim Crow, lynching, poor inner schools, and maybe bad diet, things like that. And the second theory to explain why blacks have lower productivity than whites comes from the bell curve. And I mentioned Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein. And I said, you know, I'm just giving you two theories. I'm not an expert in deciding which of them is correct or if both are correct, which is more correct. But here are two theories. And that was it. And I got a good round of applause because that was, I think, the last question. And I thought nothing more of it. And then I went off somewhere. And then when I got back to New Orleans, the proverbial whatever hit the fan. I got a letter from Father Lenaney, who is the president of Loyola Baltimore, and he said, this is horrible. We apologize. I'm putting this in my own words. It's on the record. If you look at lourockwell.com and you look at my contributions on this, you'll see his exact words. But to just summarize it, it was something like, oh, Walter Block is a disgrace. You know, he can't say this. This is anti-women and anti-black. And we apologize for having him here. And while we favor free speech and open inquiry, Walter is a rotten kid. And, you know, we can't tolerate this racism and sexism. Okay. Then what happens is that the economics department at Loyola Baltimore writes another letter. Walter is a disgrace. Very similar, only they had this citation to the Gwartney Stroop book. And Gwartney and Stroop have their textbook. And what they do is they say, look, here is the black-white differential. And as you add more independent variables to your econometric equation, the differential decreases. In other words, if you take into account schooling, different number of years of schooling. If you take into account this and that, then the gap decreases. But there's still a gap, and that's due to discrimination. That's roughly what the economics department said. Tom DiLorenzo told me that, you know, obviously he didn't sign such nonsense. And there was a priest, Father Hank Hilton, who also refused to sign this. The people who wrote this, only one of, I mean, 8 or 10 or 12 of them signed this, but only one or two of them were at the seminar. So and by the way, Father Linnane wasn't at the seminar either. And, you know, they're sort of going by hearsay. So I wrote in my reply, sort of an open letter to Jim Gwartney and Richard Stroop, both of whom are co-authors of mine and friends of mine. Mm-hmm. I said, Jim, how could you do this? Just because there's a gap, why attribute it to discrimination? Maybe it's the fact that the years of schooling are not the same thing, or some of the other independent variables are misspecified. And in any case, what about the fact that if there were discrimination, there would be profit opportunities for hiring blacks because they would be underpaid? I never heard from Jim. Well, that's not true. I did hear from Jim. And what he said was something, I don't remember the exact words, but he said, well, I refuse to argue with people who are as supportive of free enterprise as am I. And Rick, I never heard from, which is a little disappointing because here is a mistake in their textbook, and I wonder what they'll do when they revise this textbook. Will they change this? Because this is an abomination, and it allows people like the economics department at Loyola, Maryland, to bash me and say, well, even Gwartney and Stroop say this. Well, Gwartney and Stroop are mistaken on this. The third chapter occurred in my own school, Loyola, New Orleans, where the diversity task force, right? Yes, I'm glad you laugh at that, because this is a very funny thing, the diversity task force. They're interested in diversity of skin color and gender and ethnicity and this and that and the other. The only thing that they're not interested in is diversity of ideas, which is a little strange for university, but we'll let that pass. So they write a letter very similar to the first two letters. You know, Walter Block is a disgrace. He marginalizes women. He marginalizes blacks, like as if I mistreat my black and female students. And there's this guy, Wing Fok, who is a colleague of mine at the business school. He was the one member of the diversity task force from the business school. And he had the, I don't know, I was going to say temerity, but maybe I'll be nicer and say his view was that the burden of proof is on me to prove that I'm not a racist or a sexist, which is a little strange. I mean, you know, it's sort of hard to prove that you're not something. And then I said, well, you know, Wing, he and I are buddies. We're always friends. We still have a good relationship, I think. I don't know. I said, well, first of all, the burden of proof is not on me to prove a negative. But if the burden of proof really were on me, why didn't your committee have me come down to meet with them and I could maybe establish that I'm not a racist or a sexist? And he had no answer to that. And what I did is I wrote a request. I said, usually a professor gives reference letters to students, but I'd like my female and black students to write a reference letter to me in my behalf saying, well, you know, you've had me for a semester or two or three, and have I marginalized you? Have I disparaged your views because you were black or female? And I got all sorts of letters back saying, well, yes, you did disparage my views, but not because I was female or black, but you disparage everyone's views that doesn't agree with you, and it's a great class, and you keep us on our toes, and you argue with us, and you've been a great light in my career, and you co-authored this article with me, and I love you, and stuff like that, and this is crazy. So the final thing on this is that March 25th, I booked one of the biggest rooms in Loyola, New Orleans, a room that holds maybe 500 people, and I'm going to give my own. What I'm going to do is I'm going to retell the Baltimore speech, and then I'm going to talk about what I'm now talking about, namely the what happened afterward, and I'll be replying to my critics.
Well, fantastic, and I want to urge everybody to take a look at Walter's archive at lewrockwell.com, whereas this is all covered, and also look at Tom DiLorenzo's archive. He's got some great articles. In fact, this podcast, Walter, makes me think we should assemble a Block controversy archive or a Block diversity archive, where we'd have your articles and Tom's articles, make it easy for people to get up to speed on what's happening. And this is, of course, an example of how free thought is being shut down in universities and other places in the country But this time they picked on somebody who was both tenacious and smart. And I think they've never encountered anybody like you. In fact, I'm not aware in all of academia where somebody has fought back so successfully and made them sorry they ever did it. And I know that the presidents of Loyola at New Orleans and Loyola at Baltimore are still getting angry letters from alumni and otherwise from people who are friends of the institution to denounce them for this horrible business. I think you've done some great good for your colleagues as well as for the cause of truth by fighting back, and that's not unusual for you, Walter Block. So thanks for coming on the podcast, and thanks for everything you do.
Let me just respond to that. I don't know about tenacious and smart, but I am on sabbatical. And and in one of my remarks, I said, don't pick on people who are on sabbatical because they've got plenty of time to fight back. And I just wanted to thank Tom DiLorenzo for inviting me, for supporting me. He's been magnificent. He's now inviting Walter Williams to come to his school and give roughly the same sort of speech that I gave. And I'd like to see Lenaney and these other people say, by the way, Walter Williams is a black economist, and he's going to explain why blacks make less money than whites. And I'd like to see Lenaney and the economics department at Maryland say, well, Walter is a racist.
Walter Block, thanks a million.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Lou Rockwell Show. Produced by LouRockwell.com, the best-read libertarian website in the world. Thanks for listening.